Hey, good morning. Happy Friday. Welcome to Jay's Top Class. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. We made it.
Did we?
Yeah.
We have 2 hours to go.
Yeah, we made it to Friday.
Sure, we did make it to Friday. We'll see if we make it to the weekend.
We'll make it. We'll make it through the 2 hours.
I believe you.
We'll talk to Arjun Namala.
Yes.
We'll talk to Pat Malcaro, play-by-play voice of the Buffalo Bisons. We'll talk to Ben Nicholson-Smith. We'll talk to Adam Aronson to get the Phillies side of things and set up Jays at Phillies, starting with Ranger Suarez against Kevin Gausman tonight. It's a 6:45 start. We'll talk a little Max Scherzer. He's going to start for the Bisons at 6:35 tonight. We'll talk a little Treya Savage and Gage Stanifer, who both had really good starts in the minor league system yesterday. You are just grumpy, though, because the Jays are win. And you went to Drag Bingo yesterday and lost.
Wow.
Came in. I was so excited. I wanted to hear the story. I wanted to hear about the dubs. It was nothing. Straight L's.
Yes.
I think that explains the look on your face. Well, I probably explain the look on your face right now. But the mood is, this is bingo related.
Yeah, it probably is bingo related. It is very frustrating to be the only table that didn't get a win at Drag Bingo.
So nobody on your team won. It wasn't just you.
It was bad. So
losers.
You know, it was hard. And there was one point where I was like, okay, this is good. I'm off to got a good start here. It's 4-5. I'm gonna win this round. And then I went like 0-22, and I lost. But listen, if you look under the hood, Blake, the underlying numbers really tell you that I'm about to break through. So maybe next month at Drag Bingo at the Drake. It's a good time. You guys should check it out.
The underlying numbers being better than the actual. You sound like Brent Rooker right now.
Great segue.
Yes. There was an article published this morning at The Athletic from Evan Drellick and our pal Eno Saris about how the balls have changed again. And we talked about this with Dr. Meredith Wills last year, who is a physicist who in her spare time has been examining the construction of baseballs over the years. And basically, a hard hit fly ball is going about 4 feet shorter than we would expect than last year. Now, overall, home runs per at-bat are in line with last year. Run scoring is in line with last year. Batting average is actually slightly up. So there's not a huge effect in terms of outcomes just yet, but it is notable. And the people who measure the drag coefficient on the ball have raised the flag that there is more drag on it than in years past. So the league now has to examine, you know, the manufacturing process. And this is before we even get down the line with, like, tariffs may change how they source baseballs.
That was in the article as
well. Yeah, right now they get minor league balls from China and major league balls from Costa Rica. That might have to change. And for anyone who doesn't know, the baseballs are all, like, handmade. Yeah. And they're all natural material. So Major League Baseball's stance has often been there are natural variations in the manufacturing process, and that can cause some season-to-season or batch-to-batch changes. Now, the people who study this more intently have studied it over the years and been like, that's maybe true the last couple years.
Right.
Things are pretty consistent. But there was a patch of time there where you guys were juicing these things a little bit. There was obviously the like, not actually a conspiracy theory, but the wink-wink during Aaron Judge's ball chase that, like, hey, how come he gets a special ball? And it's because they want to authenticate it and have it ready and things like that. But it was also a wink-wink. Are these a little juicier? Are the ones he hit almost in my lap to left field in Rogers Center?
Were you there?
I was there for the tying one.
Right on.
Yeah, I went as a fan to all three of those games and sat in left field, like, hoping.
Yeah, that's really cool. It's nice that you were there for.
Yeah, I was there for the tying one, not the.
Yeah, I remember at the time Kevin Gausman got a start in that series, and he was just talking about, he didn't really get into, you know, are the balls any different or whatever, but he did say, listen, it's distracting as the pitcher to, you know, have someone come in and hand you new balls for that at bat. It's like it kind of takes you out of the flow. And those comments did not go well on the internet, I'll tell you that much. But he has a point, right? As for balls moving more, moving less, flying more, flying less, I'd say baseball is kind of an exact science. And listen, I didn't read the article. I would love to. I think that's super interesting. But you kind of look at, you know, even the fact that these balls are not machine made, they're not supposed to be all the same. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
However, if there is a pattern in the way that the balls are moving or flying, then I think that's what raises the flag, because, like, if they're supposed to be different, then the numbers should be all over the place, but if you're just pointing in one direction, it kind of points you in that direction, right?
If the drag coefficient is higher, and that means that balls are flying a little bit, and I am not a physicist, but mm-hmm. in reading the article and having talked to Dr. Meredith Wills last year about this, the pattern is directionally significant. Hmm. The Dr. Alan Nathan, who is the physicist who has helped consult Major League Baseball on these issues in the past and was quoted in the piece, said basically, like, this is definitely at a level that is notable, mm-hmm. but it requires much further study to understand the why and the how specifically. The popular theory is always, like, is not actually, like, juicing the balls. It's like, well, the seam height or the seam width has changed. We heard pitchers complain about that a little bit last year. You know, blisters are up or something like that, or the balls aren't mudded as effectively beforehand, so the pitchers have a little bit of trouble with the, you know, getting the grip on the seam and getting kind of the bite on the stuff. Obviously, you look at the stuff metrics around the league. No one's having trouble spinning the ball, even without the sticky tack and stuff like that. Anyway, the segue that I had initially planned and forgot to do is Brent Rooker of the Athletics is quoted in this, and Brent Rooker's awesome. In the offseason, like once the Athletics are eliminated, he's very active on Twitter explaining hitting things to people, answering questions about kind of the science of hitting or analytics and things like that. He's going to make a great broadcaster when he's done, if he wants to do that stuff. But he gets quoted in this piece as saying, maybe the extra drag is why my expected slugging percentage is 100 points higher than my actual slugging percentage, which is a really funny spin on it.
It is.
And it's, I guess technically it's only 65 points of difference between his actual and his real, but very funny to get a quote from a player for this story.
Yeah.
And the guy points to his expected stats,
almost
you did with your expected X bingo.
Yeah, I mean, I sound, I guess, a little more of a sore loser than Brent Rooker does when he says that, but it is one of those quotes where it's like, oh man, that player was probably just thinking out loud there and he couldn't filter himself fast enough and this came out on the record. And you can't help but hypothesize about these things, right?
Yeah. So that's interesting. You can read that at The Athletic. Here's a bit of news coming out of this morning. Right as we came on air, John Heyman of the New York Post is reporting that, get this, so yesterday on Aaron Civale's birthday, he gets moved to the bullpen, he requests a trade, and now, you know, I imagine he blew out his candles and was like, give me a trade. Monkey's paw. Aaron Civale has been traded to the Chicago White Sox.
No way.
Yeah.
Wow.
We don't know the specifics yet, but John Heyman reporting that Aaron Civale is a White Sox now, which, the consequences of your own actions, bud.
Yeah, that is that's pretty fascinating. I mean, listen, if what he wants is to start, then sure, sounds like an opportunity. I'm sure, or you know, I would imagine that maybe he would want to go to a winning team and actually help them make the postseason and all of that. But it's a trade-off, isn't it?
Yeah, the funniest part of this would be if the White Sox put him in the bullpen instead of having him start.
They wouldn't do that.
Yeah, I mean, they are patching together that. Look, they're like fill-in guys have actually been pretty good. Like Mike Vassell's been fine for them.
Right.
I think they would probably prefer not to be running the service time on three young starters at once in a non-competitive year. And maybe, I mean, the results are good enough for at least Shane Smith. Like Shane Smith is going to be in the Rookie of the Year conversation. I think he was a Rule 5 guy as well, so they can't send him down. But they could probably justify sending Sean Burke down. Anyway,
right.
This is more White Sox talk than anyone needs. So let's talk about the Brewers instead. We're going to talk to you, Savage, and Gage Sanifer in a minute. But because we talked about Jacob Mizorowski so much yesterday, we should do a little Miz Biz off the top. And feel good that we talked about it. I mean, I think he's such an exciting prospect anyway. But then he goes out and in his major league debut throws 5 no-hit innings before rolling his ankle on the mound and having to be taken out of the game. They called it quad and calf cramps. He's 6'7" in gangly. He kind of like walks around the mound like a baby giraffe. Yeah. I know that was Brandon Belt's old nickname. But yeah, just like hopping around and he twists his ankle trying to get back on the mound. But yeah, 5 no-hit innings with 5 Ks. Pretty good stuff.
Yeah, very good stuff. I mean, obviously his first pitch in the majors was a 100-mile-an-hour fastball. It had to be.
Light work.
Average 99, I think it was. 94 on the slider. And it's really good stuff, right?
94-mile-an-hour slider on average is ridiculous.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. And so, good start. We're kind of, listen, If you're watching sort of what happened there, he is sort of hopping and then he rolls his ankle. It's unfortunate. He also just threw away the pitch, right? It was kind of an unfortunate situation to happen at that point in the game.
It is not the most coordinated a professional athlete
not
has ever
at
looked.
Not at all. And it's so funny that the stuff is so good, but this is how he moves when he's not on the mound.
The good thing is they were saying after the game, he doesn't even expect to miss time.
Like, right.
It's fine, but you got to do it. For precaution.
For sure. I mean, the guy just came up. The last thing that you want is for him to get hurt here, especially with the type of potential that he is showing. To throw five no-hit innings in your debut is really spectacular, but it's kind of also pretty funny that we're going to remember him for rolling his ankle.
Yeah, I mean, well, you'll remember him for that if, like, that's it. Like, if he's never good again. But if he ends up being very, very good, like, that'll be, instead of it being like we remember him for that, it'll be a footnote, like how, I mean, Roy Halladay obviously famously had a 10.64 ERA and had to go back down and things like that. But there's also the, like, Bobby Higginson breaks up the no-hitter in the eighth or ninth inning against him. And, like, that was kind of the, until Roy Halladay became Roy Halladay. So it'll be, like, maybe that'll be Mizorowski. Like, yeah, you had a no-no going in your debut and had to get yanked because you rolled your ankle until you become Jacob Mizorowski. And then it becomes a footnote.
It's just a trivia question or something like that. Yeah. I mean, listen, good start for him. I'm always excited to see these young prospects come up and, mm-hmm. especially when it comes to their health, I think that caution is a good thing as well. Yeah. So we're in a good place.
And he turned out better than Kodai Senga, who hurt his hamstring and is in the middle of, like he's right there with Paul Skeens. And I know there are other names in the National League, but if we're going by ERA, Kodai Senga and Paul Skeens kind of top of the pile in the NL Cy Young race about 40% of the way through the season. He hurt his hamstring yesterday and he is going on the IL. So that sucks. Also sucks the Yankees beat the Royals 1-0. That was something we were keeping an eye on. Mm-hmm. So the Jays are back to 4.5 behind. There was fun stuff going on in the Blue Jays system as well.
Yeah, you were busy last night. You were
still
working.
I watched these this morning.
Okay, both of them?
I didn't watch them last night. Okay. I watched, I had an eye on Mizorowski last night, but this morning I watched Gage Stanifer's first start with High A Vancouver because even though we talk about him in the same lump with Yu Savage and Cal Steven, he'd been piggybacking behind Yu Savage. If you remember the old, like, Aaron Sanchez, Noah Syndergaard, Justin Nicolino prospect group, they would also piggyback each other in pairs, like three innings, four innings, to keep the innings low down and things like that. So this was Stanifer's first start
in High A Vancouver.
His first start this season. Even he didn't start at Dunedin either. He's been piggybacking Yu Savage basically all the way through. And
tough start a little bit, no?
Maybe a little too amped up. 32 pitch first inning, 3 hits and a pair of walks. Really settled in from there, though. Finished with 10 strikeouts. As the game went along, he just, like, it's so fascinating. Like, his fastball location wasn't that great, and he couldn't spot at the top of the zone. And then once he started figuring out, it was a lot of, like, in-zone sliders. Mm-hmm. So just, like, you get that up-down plane break, but in the zone. So a good amount of swing and miss on that. Finished with 10 strikeouts.
Zone, eh?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, a lot of slider in
That's
the zone.
Very impressive.
Yeah, so he is at now, he has thrown 45 innings this year. He has 74 strikeouts, a 180 ERA, and he has yet to give up a home run.
Yeah, that's really impressive. And listen, I know that there's still sort of a conversation about, is Stanifer a starter? Will he be a reliever? Yeah. When you watch a game like that, first of all, are you thinking about that? And second of all, what do you see?
Yeah, I mean, it's so early on. Yeah. Like, when you're at High A, in the lower levels of the minors, like, this is reductionist, but, like, the primary thing I care about is, are you missing bats? Mm-hmm. If you're not missing bats at the lower level and, like, you're, what is he? He's 21 years old. So, like, if you're not missing bats at that level, you're not, you could be interesting, but that's the first thing I'm looking for. When you get to Double A, I want to see, you know, I want to look at the walk rate. I want to look at the home run rate and things like that. I think really at this point, all that's important in his development is that the stuff is nasty and he's getting a lot of swing and miss on it.
That leads us quite nicely to Trey Savage.
So like the bar for Stanifer and Cal Steven is not quite as high. Johnny King's been dominant at the FCL. I haven't got to put eyes on any of those games, but like the only thing I really care about, especially in the FCL, when like you're pitching against guys who are, you know, 18 and maybe just got to America and things like that, and are still like figuring out how to be players. I want him. You better be missing bats. Mm-hmm. And then as you get to the higher levels, the bar changes. You got to have control. You got to have the home runs. Stanifer also has a really nice ground ball rate. So if you're thinking about things like, you know, could he go, you know, could he handle some hard contact here and there? Well, he keeps it on the ground a little bit. And then, yeah, when you get bumped to double A, even if it's only after four starts at high A, the bar gets a little higher. And if you walk the first three batters of the game on 15 pitches, that is maybe more concerning than it is at high A. Yeah, Trey Savage did that. He walked the first three batters of the game on 15 pitches and then only allowed one of those runs to score because he got a couple of weak pieces of weak contact, sack fly, scored one. He finished it, and then he settled in. And he was like the second inning through the fourth inning, a ton of swing and miss stuff. He ended up going four innings, one earned run, only one hit off him. It was a leadoff double in the second, but that got stranded. So only the one run, four walks, four strikeouts, 13 swing and miss. I think he only had two in the first inning. So like after the second through fourth inning, he was getting the nasty stuff. Now, double A, we don't have StatCast stuff for. Right. So I'm trying to judge like what was a fastball, what was a slider, et cetera, based off my eye. And we don't have radar readings either for those ones. So we don't.
Camera angles are different. Yeah. It's a little bit harder to pick up.
But I will say this, from the second through the fourth, the slider looked good. And the weirdness of the fastball coming from way up here. And if you're on radio, imagine me reaching, reaching very, very high. He's funky. And it looked, it looked pretty good.
Let me ask you this about those walks to start. And I know, again, you know, eyeball, I understand that there isn't a way really to check on this, but were the misses egregious or was it like, was he nibbling?
He was nibbling. Okay. And like that, we can't, like, I mean, I watched the game. So like it looked like one of the, I think the third walk was a four pitch walk and three of them were like right on the outside edge. Like he was clearly trying to stay on the outer part of the plate and he missed this spot a couple of times, but he missed it by like half a ball width. Right. This wasn't like Rick Ankiel throwing it to the backstop kind of misses. And I would be, I have never talked, well, I guess I have scrummed Trey Savage. I've never talked to him one-on-one. I would absolutely understand if the explanation coming out of this one was he was really amped up because he got bumped to double A and like walked the first three guys and then really settled in from there. Similar to Stanifer having like, you know, a 32 pitch first inning in his first start, like being a little fired up for it.
It's weird because Trey Savage has made 12 starts at the pro level. Of course he's going to be a little amped up. That's part of it. That's normal. But, you know, we're talking about the fact that he has dominated competition so far, and it's a good thing for him to face hitters that are not going to get cheated as easily. They're not going to chase as much. And how do you respond to that? It seems like he responded particularly well here.
Yeah, and started getting the swing and miss stuff going. So, you know, if that had spiraled, it's one start. I don't think it would have told you a ton. But this is part of why the Blue Jays want to be aggressive with him. And I mentioned this when we were talking, when we got asked in the text line about his potential viability late in the year or something like that. It's awesome if he goes up and dominates. And you're like, okay, he's ready for AAA. But part of the learning process in general is like you do want to see how a guy responds to a bad inning, a bad game here and there, because that's going to happen at the major league level. So I think this is a good first step. Even if the four walks are not something you're thrilled about, the fact that he started the game really poorly and still managed to give them four innings of one run ball and got some swing and miss going, I think you come away from this pretty encouraged. And next time out, obviously you want the walks to be like if he walks the first three batters of the game next time out, that looks a little different. I think that's a really good response. That's something you're happy to see. The only other note from the minors, Nick Sandlin finally pitched in that game. We thought he was going to pitch Tuesday for Buffalo. He pitched yesterday. He only went a third of an inning because he allowed four runs on four hits. But he threw 16 pitches. That's the most important thing when a guy's working his way back. Yeah. Elsewhere in the minors, so Gage Stanifer started that game. Arjun Amala picked up a hit in it. We talked to Arjun Amala yesterday. We got to spend about 10, 12 minutes with Arjun ahead of Vancouver Canadiens against Spokane. And let's play that tape now. By the way, if you want more prospect stuff, we're going to talk to Pat Malacaro, voice of the Bisons, around 10:35 as well. But for now, here is our chat with Arjun Amala from yesterday. Arjun, thanks so much for doing this, man. How's it going? The Canadiens are rolling a little bit right now.
Oh, it feels good. I mean, I know we had a little bit of a tough stretch before this in Eugene. But, it feels good to be back and to do what we know how to do, and that's win. So it feels really good.
How are you enjoying – I know you guys are on the road right now, but playing the games at the Nat, at Nat Bailey Stadium. I used to live out in Vancouver and got to go to a bunch. Always a great atmosphere as a fan. How are you enjoying it?
It's amazing. And, you know, I think anything that's been said before, it's true. You know, the fans are amazing. The atmosphere, just playing in the stadium itself, I think it's super cool. So just being able to win as a team and also enjoy like the things that come with Nat Bailey are sick.
Arjun, you've been around for a little bit now in the pros and the minors. How has your comfort level evolved as you've gone along here?
It's definitely getting better and better every day. You know, I think personally my goals are just to get better every day and, you know, help the team win. So I think every day I go out there and do what I can to, you know, keep doing that. And I think that every day it's, you know, getting easily better and better.
So at the risk of we're recording this on Thursday and it's going to air on Friday, so you might hit number 11 tonight, who knows, but you're sitting here with 10 home runs right now. Obviously the power side of things seems to have really kind of clicked for you this year. What are you feeling at the plate? Where are you feeling, you know, offensively compared to this time last year maybe?
Yeah, I think things are clicking a lot better than it was last year. You know, at this time last year, I think I was on the dev list and just working on things mentally, physically, mechanically, things like that, you know. And this year's, you know, end of last year, it kind of clicked as a whole. And then going into this year, just carrying those things as well as my personal goals. And, you know, it's gone very well and everything's going pretty well. I'm just going to keep going forward.
So last year when you did go on the dev list, so for anyone who doesn't remember, you were in A ball and then about 3 weeks you were not in game action. You were at the player development complex. Then you got in a couple complex league games before you went back to single A Dunedin. What was that time on the developmental list like? Like, what were you working on day to day? Can you take us through a little bit of those couple weeks?
Yeah, it was just, you know, getting up early and going in there and kind of using the traject lab that we have, seeing pitches, just talking with the hitting coaches, just mentally – getting mentally prepared for guys, as well as, you know, just physically getting better on the baseball field, whether it was like swing, just doing everything that I could to, you know, put myself in the best position to compete every day.
You mentioned the mental side of things here, Arjun, and I'm wondering, you know, how much confidence is built out of, and I know you've spoken about, you know, learning through struggles and all of that, but how can a moment like that build your confidence when you're back to game action, you're actually seeing the results now, right?
Yeah, I think it's a little easier when you get that little step back and you're like, okay, I'm not playing. So now I can really, really hone in on, you know, just being confident in the skills that I have. You know, I've always been a pretty confident guy, I would say, but it was just really trusting the ability that I have and just allowing that to translate into game action.
So when we look at where your numbers are, at least this season, the power pops, your strikeout rate's also way down. And I know that started to happen at the end of last year as well. Is that a conscious thing that you've worked on, or is that just the byproduct of, you know, you think you're having better at-bats up there and you know, better overall game plan?
Yeah, definitely just having better at-bats and just being more disciplined up at the plate, swinging at good pitches and taking the bad ones. You know, I think it's just also being aggressive early in the count and being able to put my best swing on a ball. So I think it's just a mixture of doing good things that's allowing me to do that.
Arjun, how much of a challenge or how fun is it to sort of stay one step ahead, right? As you move up and you're still young for the competition that you're facing right now, how do you see, I guess, that side of things of, you know, adapting as the game gets harder as well?
Yeah, I think it's just, like I said before, just learning every day. You know, I think every jump is a big jump, whether it's like the pitching gets better or the guys are older, anything like that. I think it's just trying to learn and adapt every single day and get better, like you said.
Speaking of the big jump and it getting harder, I know you guys have a game tonight. Are you guys going to have Trey Yesavage's AA game up? You guys going to keep an eye on that in the clubhouse?
Probably. I mean, I think he's been great. He was here for like 4 starts, so we barely got to see him anyway. So he's doing great. He's a great pitcher. He's a great guy. So we're definitely going to be watching him, but we're also going to try to get that dub as well.
Yeah, and so because he got the bump, Gage is going to start tonight. I know he's only been up a couple times for you, but when you guys get those three, Yesavage for a couple starts, Gage Stanifer, Cal Steven, like how nasty is the stuff? We see the box score, we see the highlights, but you get to see them pretty up close from shortstop playing behind them. How good are these guys?
They're all great. I mean, I'd like to say everyone in our whole pitching staff's great. The relievers, the starters, everyone's really, really good. But
good answer.
Just having those three, especially. I mean, Trey, for the very short time that we had him, they've all been really good. And, you know, it's kind of exciting to have that on a team.
Is it, I guess, you know, a little tempting to start thinking about, hey, this obviously we're taking some steps here, but you're seeing some guys progressing and you kind of know where this is supposed to end up, right? How do you, I guess, manage staying where you are with the possibilities of the future?
I think, yeah, it's just every day, it's own day. You know, I'm trying to stay focused on today's game and then, you know, tomorrow's game every day, just own day, trying to get better and help the team win. So whatever happens, you know, it's kind of not in my control, I would say. But, you know, the only things I can control is what I do on the field.
So, Arjun, this isn't about your game specifically, but last year, late in the season, Francisco Lindor was here, and he got asked about you a little bit and talked about, you know, he really believes in the talent. I know you guys have a bit of a relationship. What has that meant to you over these first couple pro years to have not just a vet guy in your corner, but like a perennial all-star guy at your position in your corner like Francisco Lindor?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, every offseason I get the opportunity to kind of just practice with him and just live alongside him on a baseball field. And it's huge. I think just having someone like that, especially him being an all-star MVP candidate, it just, you know, I kind of become like a sponge. I just try to take everything out of him and, you know, apply that to myself. So I think just having that has been a huge stepping stone in my career for sure.
And then we also hear a lot, Arjun, about your swing and about how there's a little bit of Mookie Betts in there. Is that a fair comparison in your mind? And is that on purpose in any way, shape, or form?
Yeah, I think I've always had that kind of two-hand finish where I kind of just finish high and it looks kind of like that. But any comp I get to big league guys, I'm going to take them, you know, especially a guy like Mookie Betts. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a pretty, those are pretty, two pretty good names, Francisco Lindor and Mookie Betts to be in the conversation with. So Arjun, those are guys, maybe you can model your game after a little bit, but a very cool thing about your story so far is that you are one of the first generation Indians to get drafted as high as you did in any of the four major North American sports. You would be one of the first players in Major League Baseball when you eventually get there of Indian descent. I know you've been asked this before, but as you continue on and your maturity level is obviously very high, how do you carry that responsibility and how much does that mean to you to be, you know, there are going to be some players a couple years from now who are talking about Arjun Amala the way that you are talking about Francisco Lindor or Mookie Betts?
Yeah, I think it means a lot. You know, for me, it's always been, you know, trying to play baseball at the highest level and become the best player that I could possibly. So, you know, the things that come with that are very important as well. And I'm super proud of that. And I think that another big goal of mine is to help inspire other athletes, Indian athletes, to play not only baseball, but sports in general. You know, I think it's a huge, huge part of life. And, you know, I think it's very inspiring and motivating for me.
Arjun, when we hear about the maturity level, about your focus on the game, and you're going through and you're facing competition that is older than you, that's been around for a little bit longer than you, and at the same time, there's just so much hype, right? There's so much talk around you as well. How do you stay focused? And, you know, how much of a challenge can that become when there's so much around you?
Yeah, it could definitely become a challenge. You know, it can be hard to, you know, manage that. But for me, it's always just staying in control of what I can control, you know, and that's just putting my best effort out there every day on the field, off the field, just doing the little things that I do every day to help put myself in the best position. So, you know, it's never thinking about the outside perspective or trying to do too much. It's always just doing what I know I should be doing.
Before we let you go here, I know you guys got a game at the Nats Spokane in town, and you got three afternoon games Friday, Saturday, Sunday, which is always a good part of the schedule. What do you think, your individual stuff aside, you guys have turned such a corner as a team and you're looking to keep that rolling against Spokane the rest of this week. What's gone into that? What do you think's working for the Vancouver Canadians lately?
Yeah, I think, you know, team is clicking on all spheres. You know, the bats are really starting to swing it better. I think we've been putting up really good at-bats as a whole. You know, the pitching staff has really done a good job of, you know, commanding the zone and allowing the defense to play behind them. So I think it's just a mixture of really good pitching and really good at-bats that's allowing us to, you know, get ahead and score a lot of runs as well as not let the others score anyways. Yeah.
It's fun to see everyone's like, oh, the Jays have won 12 of the last 14. The Canadians have won 14 of the last 16. Yep. Just saying, the Jays got to step it up. Arjun, we got to let you go to get ready for the game. Thank you so much for doing this. It was great to finally chat.
Of course. Thank you guys for having me.
And as it turns out, the Canadians won another game yesterday. They beat Spokane 10-6. And now they'll play three at the Nat, 1 o'clock Friday, Saturday, Sunday, 1 o'clock Pacific time.
I have to say, I'm a little disappointed that our interview didn't end up being dated and he didn't pick up his 11th.
Yeah, but it was the first thing I checked. By the way, I mentioned earlier, John Heyman had reported that Aaron Civale is getting traded to the White Sox. The return is Andrew Vaughn, who makes $6 million and had been stashed in AAA because he had not been playing particularly well for the White Sox. There's also cash going, according to James Fagan. So I would imagine that's a because both those teams are broke boy teams, they'll probably make it cash neutral and trade Savale for Andrew Vaughn.
What a situation. We love some drama going on in mid-June.
It's like the low-end drama, though. The fifth.
We'll take what we can get.
Veteran fifth starter dealt for quad A first baseman. We could do better than that. Well, we won't do it next segment because it's not drama, but there is a lot of excitement in Buffalo today because Max Scherzer is going to make his Buffalo Bisons debut. It was also Bark at the Park night last night.
Oh,
at the Bisons game?
We have to ask about
that. So let's talk a little Buffalo Bisons. In the second hour, we'll talk to Ben Nicholson-Smith. We'll talk to Adam Aronson. We'll get you set up for the Jays-Phillies series. But after the break, we'll go down to Buffalo. We'll talk Max Scherzer's start tonight with Pat Malacaro, voice of the Bisons. That's next as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. Jays back in action at 6:45 tonight. At 6:35, you'll want to fire up MILB TV as well because Max Scherzer will be on the hill for the Buffalo Bisons. Let's go down to Buffalo and talk about it. Joined now by the voice of the Bisons, Pat Malacaro. Pat, good morning. How are you, man?
Great to chat with you guys. And yeah, it's a fun day here in Buffalo. Certainly when the news started to break from John Schneider earlier in the week that this was a possibility, it's exciting that we're going to have a three-time Cy Young Award winner here in Buffalo tonight.
Excitement level higher or on par with dogs at the ballpark night last night?
I mean, those are in a category of their own, but certainly having a Cy Young winner from both leagues and a multi-time World Series winner is pretty high up there.
Yeah, so, different dog in the park today, I will say. That's got to be one of the most peculiar parts of your job, right, Pat, when you have someone like that kind of come in and throw a rehab start or have a rehab stint there. What is that like for you?
It's fun. Last night, Nick Sandlin pitched on a rehab assignment here in Buffalo as well. So it's just, you know, getting to see the guys' interactions, the players' interactions with some of the major league talent is probably the part of it that I enjoy the most. And I know it wasn't a rehab last year, but, you know, having Joey Votto with the team for 6 weeks last year. You know, Eric Swanson's rehabbed plenty in the last couple of seasons. So just a lot of the big league players and seeing some of the younger players understand what it takes to go about your routine. I think that's such an underrated part of kind of what I like to watch and see on a game day and during batting practice, during throwing programs, and even all the way through the end of the night.
So you mentioned a couple names there, and Votto was there for 15 games last year. That was a lot of fun. You, and that's, you know, you're giving us a good professional answer about the team and stuff like that. Now, you as a baseball fan who is also calling these games, where does the fact that you're going to get the call of Max Scherzer start rank for you? Like, Votto is obviously very, very cool, too, and we're Canadian here, so the Votto thing took on a little extra importance. Is Scherzer, like, top of the list? Is it in the mix at the top? How are you feeling?
Yeah, it's top three for sure. He actually pitched against the Bisons on a rehab assignment with Syracuse.
Nice.
And I think it was 2022. So did get an opportunity to call a game of his in the past, but not in front of a Bisons home crowd. And, you know, being someone from Buffalo, I can remember going to games where, whether it was an exhibition where Barry Bonds hit a ball off the scoreboard in center field and the base of it, you know, things like that. That's what I think about on days like today is I remember watching Doc Gooden throw a couple of games here in Buffalo and actually being a bat boy for one of those games or watching Jim Thome hit a home run into right field in a playoff game. So those are the things I think about on today. And this is certainly right at the top of that list.
Like imagine you're a kid and this is one of your like formative baseball experiences and you maybe don't have the grasp just yet of how special it is. And then like 5-10 years from now, you're going to be like, holy crap, I was at a Max Scherzer start in Buffalo. It's cool to think about. The other thing that comes to mind is, so the Dunedin Blue Jays are doing a Joey Votto bobblehead night on June 28th. Like there's a chance we're getting some like Max Scherzer Bisons night down the line as well, which would be like a very, like, I think they're only doing 1,000 of the Votto bobblehead. If you do a Max Scherzer Bisons bobblehead next year or something like that, that's going to be a very exclusive merch item too.
Yeah, and another reason for fans to come down from across the border. So any reason to get folks down here, certainly. And, you know, and another part of this is for fans that maybe get a chance to go on the field pregame or players that come into the ballpark, outside of our clubhouse at the ballpark at Salem Field, there's a display of all the players that have played in a game in a Bison uniform rehab or full-time player that are in Cooperstown. So this, you know, could be adding a couple of names to that list. CeCe Sabathia will go on that wall very soon. And, you know, there's a couple of more open spots and certainly hoping to fill those again.
That's really cool. I didn't know about that. And I have been there before. I'm just going to have to drive down. I
think, I've only ever been as a fan. I haven't done one. I haven't done a game as like media.
Yeah.
Anytime I go down, I'm like, I want the beer's way cheaper and colder than it is at Rogers Center.
Why would I do work right
yeah,
now?
Yeah, exactly.
And then there's the other side of it, right, Pat, which is you also get to see a ton of talent come up here and find success. That's been the case. You know, Alan Roden is here right now, Davis Schneider, Addison Barton, Jonathan Class A. And then there's one guy who kind of came up recently and who got just the warmest welcome, apparently, in Will Robertson. Mm-hmm. Alan Roden going as far as saying that no one deserves this more. What are your impressions of Will Robertson and this moment and what it means to him?
Yeah, I think this is one of those really cool stories that you love as a baseball fan. Somebody who, yes, he was a prospect at one point, a high draft pick, but really the last couple of years, and this isn't a slight against Will, he had to fight and claw for every opportunity that he's had here in Buffalo. Even dating back to the beginning of last season, he wasn't expected to be an everyday outfielder, but he plays such solid defense and he can play really any three of the positions. Probably the corners or right field is the best, but he can play either corner in the big leagues and play it admirably. And his power at times is very streaky. But when he goes on one of these streaks, like we saw in Syracuse last week, even before that, a couple of homers against Charlotte leading into that six-game series that made him the player of the week last week in the International League, he's just a really good teammate, somebody who, like I said, has really had to work for everything in terms of the playing time and making the most of it. And I think that rubs off on the other players as well. He goes about his work and you never see him have a bad day in the clubhouse. And, you know, just that workmanlike attitude that, you know, college teammates with Alan Roden. So he and Alan knew that about each other and their personalities. But I think certainly everybody in the Bison's clubhouse and, you know, all of us here were excited when Robertson came out of the game on Tuesday night and you kind of saw in the dugout, things were going a little bit, they were having a good time in the dugout and you kind of knew what was maybe coming.
Yeah, it's always great to see. It's always great to see or hear the reaction of guys when that guy calls up, because there's a big Buffalo presence on this Blue Jays team right now. You know, Roden's here, and Davis Schneider is back up, Addison Barger, Jonathan Class A. And the other element of this is now Will Robertson's here because the Blue Jays have three outfielders on the IL. Pat, you guys got a couple of outfield reinforcements, two guys who are hitting really, really well in Double-A in Yohindrick Panongo and RJ Schreck. What have your initial impressions of those two been? Off to a pretty solid start as Bisons.
Yeah, and I think that's the one key is the versatility and something we've seen for several years from Blue Jay outfield prospects. I think you can stick, especially Schreck, at any of the three outfield positions. Got a ball off the hand the other day, so he's been off the last couple of days. Nothing major, but just kind of we haven't seen him in action in the last two nights. But for Panongo, adds a little bit of power as well, and so does Schreck. And I think, you know, guy can't leave out of the conversation also is Joey Loperfido has mm-hmm. been here all year long and continues to play everyday center field right now. I think that is the biggest thing I've noticed is he's solidified into one position in center for the most part now. And, you know, right at the top of the order, Michael Stefanik filled in the big leagues for a little bit for the Blue Jays. He and Loperfido have been a really good 1-2 punch in terms of offense. Stefanik seems like he's a three-hit machine every game. Loperfido is in on base seemingly every night, whether it be a walk or a base hit. So I think the outfield prospects are really strong here in Buffalo, which has been really a hallmark of the affiliation with the Blue Jays when you see who has been in Buffalo and who has graduated to the big league level.
Pat, I did want to ask you about Loperfido because he is a name that comes up, right, when Dalton Varsho goes on the IL and things like that, and certainly Anthony Santander. But it seems like he's doing everything right here, and maybe this is more of a roster construction and allowing a prospect to get his at bats and things like that, but is that your impression as well? Is he on the right track here?
I think so, and I think you're absolutely right. You don't want a player to go to the big leagues if you're a prospect and just sit the bench for a week and then go back to Buffalo, because we saw, you know, certain players that they might go up even in previous years. You go up for a little bit, you come back down. It's not easy to go yo-yo back and forth, even if you can only go up and down a certain amount of times each year. So I think for Loperfido, that's the thing. Continue to play and play well here in Buffalo. there will be an opportunity at some point this season. That's always how it goes in pro sports. So just continue to work at it and just put the at-bats in like he's been doing. You haven't seen any drop-off when others have gone to the big leagues in terms of Loperfido. So I think that is the case of, you know, maybe Blue Jay front office just wants to see him continue to play every day instead of maybe one every couple of days in a spot role.
So David Schneider is a good example of that. He's up. He's not playing every day necessarily, even though he does have a really good on-base percentage when he does get in there at the major league level. And so when David Schneider comes back up, we get the David Schneider Ernie Clement pairing back, which is always a lot of fun. And I'm curious how fun it is for you and meaningful to Bisons fans that, like, obviously there's always a connectivity between the Blue Jays and the Bisons, but it really does seem like those guys, and particularly Ernie Clement, who's not far from the area, really carry the Buffalo name with them. And it feels like a little, it feels a little more connected than it did in years past, that Buffalo is like a big part of this Toronto team. Do you feel that as well?
Absolutely. And that is a point of pride here, whether it be, you know, with the front office, with the fans that come to games, you know, it's a partnership and fans want to go up to Toronto and want to cheer on the Blue Jays in this now over a decade affiliation. I think only things like that make the affiliation and that relationship stronger. And you see fans go up to Rogers Center a lot more often maybe than they had in the past, and, you know, get that back in their regular routine again of going to see a Blue Jays game in Toronto. We're certainly seeing a lot more Davis Schneider jerseys in the stands, and a lot more, you know, a ton of just, you know, you see Bo, you see Vladdy, you see the top players, but you're seeing a lot of those fan favorite uniforms in the stands here, just showing that the strength of that relationship.
Now, that's got to be fun for everyone, especially for you, because, you know, I always find the work of minor league people so interesting, because you do, you know, get close to these people, you do sort of create a relationship with these players and stuff like that, and then you have to see them, you know, walk away and move on to other things. It's kind of interesting to think about just from an emotional standpoint, if you will.
I think of this almost as like a school year, whereas, you know, every year the roster might look similar. You know, you go from grade 4 to grade 5, and maybe you have the same classmates here in Buffalo. A lot of the players are the same from one year to the other, but, you know, maybe the coaches change a little bit. Maybe some of the prospects graduate, but in the end of the year always feels tough, and you look back on the year and say, man, what a fun year it was. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I always look at kind of like the baseball season like a grade school year.
That's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Pat, before we let you go, I want to kind of rapid fire a couple of the guys that you've seen closer than we've been able to with the Bison. So you mentioned Nick Sandlin rehab yesterday. The stat line is whatever. Obviously, this is about getting his reps and building back up. How in your sense has Sandlin's rehab been going, and what'd you see last night?
Yeah, about as it's gone so far for him. So, and we expect to see him again in Buffalo for another appearance as part of the program to get back to the big leagues. I don't, you know, results are kind of off to the side, and the pitches looked good. It just, you ran into a couple of tough hitters, and including John Kenzie Noel, who's crushing the ball here in AAA. So he looked fine.
Yeah. That's good to know. And then I did want to ask you about Adam Macko, who debuted, I think it was last week, did pretty well. What are your first impressions of Macko?
Yeah, and coming off that knee injury, just kind of wondering how he would react in 4 innings, 4 strikeouts, no real solid contact. That to me was the biggest thing for Macko on Sunday in Syracuse is, you know, he was locating his stuff, as you're seeing right there, getting a lot of swings and misses. So I think had he been here at the start of the year, the Bison's rotation, which has been good over the last month or so with some of the players like Macko coming back, really solidified things for now this second half push and maybe settle in here in AAA, get, you know, 10, 12 starts under your belt and feel really good about how this season goes.
Back on the position player side, Aurelvis Marquez.
Yep.
Wow.
You got it.
Wow. Aurelvis Martinez is a name that we get asked about a lot. It looked like the bat had been coming around there for a little bit, kind of a cold week for him now. And I the way I understand it is the focus is getting the defense right at second base, because we all know how much power is in that bat. Where is he in that progression, you know, figuring out the second base position with a little more consistency?
I think it's starting to get there. And I think the ability at the plate and cutting down on the swing and misses also helps his defense as well. I think that those two things always go hand in hand, whether it's you're playing the field affects your at bats or vice versa. And for Aurelvis, he's made a lot of really good plays this year. And I think you look at some of the highlight reel plays, he gets to balls that maybe you wouldn't expect him to get to, sliding plays into the outfield, gets to his feet, throws to first. That's that sidearm kind of flip to first will always be an issue that he is kind of working through and figuring out. I think he'll cut down on the errant throws as the season goes on. That's maybe the one thing he'll want to work on as he gets, you know, the arm angle from second base better. And I think, again, those swings and misses that he cut down on Syracuse, I think when he feels good at the plate, you see a lot more of those top plays where you're saying, wow, how did he get to that ball?
Yeah, it's interesting because obviously we know that the athleticism is there, and it is about, I guess, just getting the fundamentals right here. Someone else that I wanted to ask you about, Pat, is Lázaro Estrada, who was such a buzzy name during camp. We were kind of looking at him pretty closely. His ERA has been a bit iffy, but he was good his last time out. I believe it was June 11th, so that was 2 days ago on Wednesday. What are you seeing from Estrada here?
I think this is just another young pitcher who is adjusting to AAA life, and you're starting to see he's settling in. For starters here in Buffalo, they basically only pitch once a week, so they're getting a little bit of extra rest, and maybe there's an adjustment period to that also, even though, you know, the minor league schedule is 6 days a week, no matter what level you're at. You're facing tougher hitters, the ABS system where, you know, you can challenge a pitch if it's not in the zone. AAA hitters are more disciplined. So there's a lot of things to work through as a young starter. And I think you're starting to see Estrada figure it out, pound the strike zone a lot more, and get hitters to get themselves out instead of, you know, trying to get guys on pitches out of the zone that you'd get at AA and you don't hear at AAA.
Who uses the challenge the most? Like, of the hitters, who's tapping the helmet most often?
Oh, that's a great question. It's a lot. The catchers are the ones that, okay, that do it almost always. And the Bisons have, as a team, it's actually a stat that is in the game notes every day provided by Major League Baseball. I love the ability to check it. The Bisons at one point were below 50% about a month ago. They're at about a 55% success rate in challenges. So they've gotten a lot better as the season has gone on. Something we saw over the first 2 years of this system. So that's an encouraging sign of, if you're a Blue Jays fan, I think it sounds funny, like they're good at challenges. What does that mean? But I do think with the way that the Blue Jay organization values plate discipline and hitters having a good eye at the plate, that is something that helped Davis Schneider significantly here in Buffalo and to hone in. And I think that helps other younger players, guys like Allen Roden that are in the big leagues now, really focus in on what are good pitches in the zone and doing the most damage when you get those.
All right, before we let you go, silly one for you, but Davis Schneider mentioned this, and then I went back and looked, and it's actually true. What's the deal with every time Casey Kendall comes up to Toronto, the Bisons go on a little heater? What's going on there?
Well, the funny thing is, I joked with Casey, he's on his actually recovery days right now. So each member of the coaching staff gets 4 days off throughout the course of the year. He's on his now. And he's seven, I think, wins away from 300 as a Bison manager. And Cesar Martin, the acting manager who's the bench coach, got credit for didn't get credit for the victories Casey did when Cesar managed the team. So if the Bisons win the three games this weekend, they would go to Casey's credit, not Cesar's, and get him closer to that 300 mark. So that's something we definitely have joked with him about in the clubhouse.
Have you ever seen the movie Mr. 3000?
Yeah.
So for anyone who doesn't know, Bernie Mac's character retires the second he gets the 3,000 hits. But then when he's about to go in the Hall of Fame, they relook at the stats, and one game got double counted. So he actually only has 2,997 hits. This is what's going to happen with Casey Kendall at some point. They're going to go back and they'll be like, yeah, you know what? Actually, those are Cesar Martin's wins. You got to come back. You got to come out of retirement 10 years from now, 15 years from now to get those extra three wins. Pat, thanks so much for doing this, man. Have a blast with Max Scherzer Day.
Thanks so much.
Pat Malcaro, voice of the Buffalo Bisons. You will hear him if you fire up MILB TV for that Max Scherzer start at 6:35 tonight. Should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it should be. It's Buffalo is kind of, it's so close, you know. It is driving distance, and it's a great time at that ballpark. I think they do a very good job with that, and you kind of think of it as a bit of a different world, but it's not. It's still the same game, right? Max Scherzer, that should be fun.
Yes, it absolutely should be. Yeah, and Buffalo, I mean, like I said, I've been down there. I've only gone to games as a fan, not to work. So I highly recommend it.
Yeah.
I should have checked before I said it. But last year they were doing a cool thing where they would take Canadian money at par, which was a great way to get Canadian people across the border down to games. Yeah. Double check that that's still the case. I don't want you to get hit with like a 30% markup when you get there. but yeah, they're fun games to get down to. Yeah. And if you can't get down to it, Pat does a really great job on the broadcast. So you can check that out on MILB TV. MILB TV. That's a tough one. It's a very Friday voice for me.
It's harder than Aurelvis Martinez.
Yeah, Aurelvis Martinez. I've said that name 10,000 times over the last couple summers. I should have that one down and not trip over it. But it's because I had Adam Macko in my head as well. Martinez. Yeah, I don't know. All right. Let's take a break. I clearly need it. In the second hour, we're going to talk to Ben Nicholson-Smith. We're going to talk to Adam Arison of the Philly Voice. We'll get you set up for Blue Jays-Phillies this weekend. It starts tonight at 6:45. Ranger Suarez against Kevin Gausman. Ranger Suarez, the lowest hard hit rate and square up rate among all qualified pitchers. So even though the Jays have done well against lefties of late, Ranger Suarez in the zone. Let's take a break. Let's talk to Ben Nicholson-Smith as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. Mentioned Max Scherzer will start for the Buffalo Bisons today. Our pal Mitch Bannon of The Athletic pointing out that it is actually the free game of the day on MILB.TV. So you don't even have to dust off your subscription or have one. I do. That's how you watch Gage Stanifer and Treya Savage early on a Friday morning.
That's right.
It's what you do,
that,
I guess.
And a lot of life choices.
Yeah.
You know?
Anyway, we just talked to Pat Malacaro, the voice of the Bison, so you can check that out again, MILB.TV. It's the free game of the day. And yeah, that'll roll into Jays Phillies nicely. Ben Nicholson-Smith was down in St. Louis for Jays Cardinals. Let's talk to him now. Ben, how you doing, man?
Hey, Blake. Hey, Julia. Doing well over here, and nice to be joining you guys.
How disappointed are you that before we could even, it was in the doc as a topic, we texted about it a little bit, before we can even get to talk about it on air, the Aaron Civale era is over. He's getting reportedly dealt to the White Sox for Andrew Vaughn. How disappointed are you that we can't even kick around, should the Jays be in on Aaron Civale?
Well, I actually don't think it's too late, because who's to say the White Sox won't flip him? So I actually think that this could be the first of two trades. So, in fact, we can continue on the Civale trade speculation, I think, all we want to, Blake.
Yeah, it is an interesting, like, if Andrew Vaughn didn't have a bunch of dead money sitting in AAA, this one wouldn't make a lot of sense. But I guess it's $8 million guy getting moved to the bullpen for a $6 million quad A guy. That's about as far as the explanation. But, yeah, it's a good point. The White Sox will almost definitely be in the market to move guys by late July.
We'll see.
Yeah.
Ben, this is what I said. We will take any type of drama we can get in mid-June. Right? If this happened at the trade deadline, we would not be talking about it so much. But with the way that things are, it's kind of nice to kick things off a bit early here.
I agree with that. I think I'll take an early trade anytime. And this one, hopefully they do better than this on July 31st as far as entertainment value, not just the Blue Jays, but across baseball. And I think they probably will, because usually there's a lot of action. And I think this is the time of year that people kind of complain, like, hey, there's nothing out there. It's going to be really hard. Then that last week, there are always a couple teams that jump in, a couple big names that pop. So, you know, we'll see where the Blue Jays fit in all of that, but it should be a fun 6 weeks.
Yeah, we'll talk about this plenty between now and the end of July, but my eyes are very much on the Arizona Diamondbacks as they kind of fall out of contention, because they have a few pending free agents who would be very, very interesting to not just the Blue Jays, to teams around baseball if they end up. They're 4.5 out of a wild card spot right now, so if things go worse there. Last note on the White Sox or non-Jay stuff, Ben. I know you have gotten a kick out of the Pope being a big White Sox fan, as we all have. Who do you think his favorite player of all time is?
Wow. I mean, from that era, probably like Mark Burley,
okay.
Maybe Joe Creedy, Jermaine Dye was on those teams.
I was thinking Paul Konerko myself.
Yeah, I could see that. I'm going to go out on a limb and say he's a big Jermaine Dye fan.
Okay.
Who's on the Vatican Beach? We need to ask.
Yeah.
Any guesses, Julia?
Well, Aaron Civale. Obviously.
Well, now Aaron Civale for sure.
Let's talk about the Blue Jays.
Yeah,
this is a lot of White Sox talk.
Ben, how was St. Louis? So you were down there for that road trip. It's a great ballpark. Where does that park rank for you among the ones that you've gotten to visit and cover games at?
It's really nice. Yeah, I really like it. I think that Fenway, Wrigley, those ones are always going to be at the top for me. Then you toss in San Francisco is incredible. Seattle's great. Baltimore, I think, is amazing. Mm-hmm. You get to go to Baltimore a lot, which is great. I really like Detroit. That's up there for me.
Well, that's so Ben Nicholson Smith country.
Yeah.
That's, you exactly. and Joe Siddle, honestly, of course, love Detroit.
Honestly. Yeah. I would say it's top half, like maybe top 10, maybe top 10. Like top 10 is tough to crack. There's so many great ballparks in Major League Baseball. But I would say it's probably 12 if I had to you know, pick off the top of my head.
That's not bad. I mean, it is a pretty storied ballpark, but you're right that there's just so many good ones, exciting stuff all around. But listen, it was a good road trip. It has been a good road trip so far. I know that there's another tough test ahead in the Phillies, but you know, you hear guys talking about how much fun they're having, and you know, maybe national guys are starting to pay a little bit more attention to the Blue Jays and how hot they are.
Or they can't get over the Ryan Yarbrough thing still if you're a certain national guy.
I guess that's also...
After an 8 earned run outing, I don't know.
We need to get over the Ryan Yarbrough thing. We've been talking about this for way too long. Yeah. But yeah, listen, you know, we've spoken about what it takes to build momentum a little bit, Ben. Where do you stand with the Blue Jays? Are you buying into the stretch right now?
Yeah, I am, and I think that... I think you have to a degree. First of all, because you just don't get that many chances to see a team doing this well, really. I mean, we looked all last year for a stretch like this. It never happened. So to win 12 of 14, if you're not going to buy in now, like, what are you waiting for? And I understand, like, you could reasonably say you're waiting for this team to actually make the playoffs and you'll buy in then. But short of that, I think they're playing really well. They've overcome a lot of obstacles. The vibes are amazing when you're kind of around the team. They feel really relaxed. They're saying, you know, just how much they're enjoying this and how much they're having fun at this point in time. So all of that is really good. I think more to the point, they've banked these wins. So you have 38 wins right now. I think that it's reasonable to think that they could get to the upper 80s at this point. That's going to put them very much in the conversation for a wild card, if not in the lead for a wild card spot. So I think it's within their grasp. Are they going to do it? I don't know. But I think that there's reason for optimism when you just look at the sheer wins that they banked and the position they put themselves in.
So this is another big series here against the Phillies. I think I kind of said it now heading into this week. I'd said if they went like if they took 4 out of 6, I'd feel very, very good. Now they swept the Cardinals, so I'm moving the bar. Like I want 2 out of 3 this weekend now. But yeah, I think, you know, we're looking at if they take 2 out of 3 here, I think we could look back at the last 3 weeks and say they were the best team in baseball over almost a month of play. And that's an important thing about how I feel about your big chances. If there are questions still, Ben, it comes in. How sustainable is it to really only have 3 starting pitchers you're relying on? Bowden Francis has been short. You're 7-2 in bullpen days, but I don't know how much how much longer that's going to last. As we project forward with this team, is that kind of the first item you're looking at in terms of the sustainability of the success the Jays have been having?
Yeah, for me, I just think you need to sort out the back of that rotation as soon as you can. Now, realistically, that might take 6 weeks. It might be until August 1st that we actually have a better sense of how this is going to fit together. So, you know, I think we need to be somewhat realistic when we're talking about the desire for certainty. Because, of course, everyone would love it if Max Scherzer went out, threw 6 shutout innings and 65 pitches tonight, and he declares himself ready to go. Then you have one rotation spot solved. You figure out the other and you're kind of fine at that point. But realistically, between Scherzer, Lauer, obviously Spencer Turnbull, obviously Bowden Francis, there are a lot of questions as far as how these pieces are going to fit together. So you can't expect that to be resolved instantaneously. And I think that trades could easily be a part of that too, and probably will be a part of that. But in the meantime, I just see them in, and this is why, you know, Blake, to get back to that Savali topic, I never really saw them as a great fit for Savali, because they have guys who are somewhat in that mold of right-handed pitchers, don't miss a lot of bats, can give you a few innings. So I think they just see how it fits together for the time being.
Yeah, and listen, when you have a guy like Eric Lauer just delivering, then you can afford to be a bit more patient, I guess. And when you have a Max Scherzer progressing, maybe you can also afford to see what or where he stands after this first rehab outing or this first outing with AAA. What are you looking for realistically from Scherzer tonight in terms of pitch count and stuff and otherwise?
For me, it would be a huge success if Scherzer can go out there, sit 92, throw, let's say, 60% of his pitches for strikes and emerge healthy. I think if he can do that, it's like an A+, and you're not even really looking at the results or looking at, you know, is he getting swing and miss with his secondaries? That'll take time. I think when Scherzer's on, we saw even this spring a couple months ago, as you guys remember, he can get major league hitters out, and he can be very effective just with his pitch ability and the way that he can live on the edges of the strike zone, even if he's throwing 92. So you don't want to see him out there throwing 89, but I think that if there's a little velo, strike throwing and physical, you know, comfort, I think he's really getting close to coming back to the majors at that point.
So that was going to be my follow-up, because they have talked about this as if it's not a standard rehab assignment, but John Schneider didn't necessarily make it seem like a return is imminent. But I wonder how much, and this is me, you know, speculating, not reporting, but if that thumb issue is something that we expect could possibly flare up again in the future, and this is around the pitch count that it's flared up in the past, does it not make sense to rush him a little bit because you'd rather have those bullets used at the major league level? Like, if he comes out of this one feeling fine and the stuff looks reasonable, maybe he gets at least one more, but could you see them kind of hotshotting him back to the majors? Not even necessarily to because you need it in the fifth rotation spot, but because if you only think you're going to get, say, 50 innings out of Scherzer, get them at the major league level.
Right. Yeah, you don't want to waste too many of those in rehab games. So I think that that makes sense. Of course, you're going to work with Scherzer in this process. Yes. So if he says he needs another outing to get his delivery right or to get his feel for his secondaries right, you're going to give him that. But if he says he's feeling comfortable in his delivery, he's repeating it, he's throwing all his pitches for strikes, yeah, I mean, go for it. I think that, you know, we're talking about a three-time Cy Young winner. We all know what Max Scherzer has done in the major leagues. And I would want to take that shot. I think that if it's him versus Spencer Turnbull, Eric Lauer, Bowden Francis, I think that you're taking the shot on Scherzer. So health first, and we'll see how he is doing with the thumb after the outing tonight.
Speaking of Spencer Turnbull, who was just a huge question mark until he got here and delivered two clean innings with a strikeout out of the bullpen, what is a realistic expectation for, you know, what he can provide for this team, what role he can occupy, you know, and based off of what we saw from that first short outing here?
You know, I'll admit my expectations were pretty low, just based on the velo readings that we had seen from Spencer Turnbull in AAA and some of the stuff you hear about, you know, just how he was progressing and some of the things he needed to work through in the minor leagues. So with those low expectations, I actually was kind of pleasantly surprised with the way that he pitched against the St. Louis Cardinals, where he was able to give them two innings, two hits allowed. He was in the strike zone. The sweeper looked like a good pitch, and the velo was up just a little bit from where he had been. So to me, this is a really good building block and something where they can continue, you know, is it two innings? Is it four innings? I certainly don't think you're turning to him for six and expecting him just to join the rotation and be an answer for you, but you need major league pitchers, and he looks right now like a major league pitcher.
Well, that's a step forward, even if it's in a bulk role for the time being. The other question mark of all of this is Bowden Francis, and John Schneider has continued to say, you know, they have trust in him. They think that he'll be able to figure it out. I said yesterday, I don't know. I have a good feeling about tomorrow's start, even though it's the Phillies. Yeah,
Blake doesn't get those very often, so we really need to pay attention.
Yeah, don't bring this up on Monday if it doesn't go that way. But yeah, I mean, so obviously the team kind of has to say those things. And there were interesting comments from Chris Bassett after Bowden Francis's last start too, about how, you know, sometimes the idea of protecting a guy or maybe sending him to the minors to figure it out maybe doesn't serve the best long-term interests of helping the pitcher get there, get where he needs to go. Now, obviously that has to be balanced against the fact that the Blue Jays are trying to make a playoff spot right now. So I guess just bigger picture with Bowden Francis, where do you think the patience level actually is outside of, like, here's the lip service because we have to support this guy publicly?
Yeah, and I think supporting him publicly makes so much sense. I mean, there's no point in, you know, talking to me or yourselves and saying, like, hey, yeah, we're really worried about this guy. It's not gonna serve anything, even if there might be some truth to that. And there should be some truth to that because we've seen the results. It hasn't been good so far this year. So, yeah, I think that if you're a serious team, you need to do everything you can to improve a rotation spot that you're getting a 6 ERA from, right? Like, this is nothing against Bowden Francis, who I believe can be a good major league pitcher again. But if you're serious about trying to contend for the postseason, you're going to evaluate your options. And so I believe that the Blue Jays thought this through with a degree of care and attention to detail that they're not really doing between Kevin Gausman starts before this upcoming start for Bowden Francis. They landed on starting him. So after that start, we'll get a lot more information, and then maybe they will have another decision to make. But yeah, I think that behind the scenes, they're evaluating this very carefully, and I think that they need to. I think that there's not really a question here. When you have someone who leads Major League Baseball in home runs allowed, what are you doing if you're not evaluating that? At the very minimum, you need to be looking closely at that. And, you know, personally, I probably wouldn't have started Bowden Francis against the Phillies. But, you know, there are reasonable people, Blake, like yourself, reasonable people out there who think that it's a good idea, and we'll see how it goes.
I mean, you and I had kicked around, I think, at the ballpark the other week, or maybe over text, the idea, like, I'm not a big opener guy. I think teams, like, have not employed it the way it was meant to be employed. There's no Sergio Romo is not walking through that door for the Rays to open these games and things like that. But if there were a spot to do it, and this is, I guess, a little less so with the Phillies having Bryce Harper on the IL and Bryson Stott moving down the order and stuff, like, they look like a pretty different Phillies team than we just saw the other week. But that is a spot, a team with a lefty masher near the top of the order, that maybe an opener would make sense, a Flew-Hardy for the first inning, get you through the Schwarber spot in the order, and then turn it over for the purposes of, if you're only going to let a guy face 15 hitters, say, you know, you get 5 through 9 and then roll it over. You don't have to face the top of the order a second time, maybe even a third time.
I like the way you're thinking. I think that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. I'm sold, Blake.
I feel like a traitor to myself, though, because I don't really like the opener in general. But I do think, like, a team with a lefty bopper at the top and a right-handed pitcher who's struggled with the long ball, like, if you were going to do it in a situation, that's the situation you do it in.
Yeah, no, exactly. No one likes doing this. No one likes contemplating this. And I think that, you know, the best case scenario would be that Bowden Francis is pitching well, or the second best case scenario is, you know, you're playing a video game and you just trade for someone and then it's solved. But the reality is, it's really hard to find impact starting pitching at this point in time. So you kind of have to figure it out with what you have. And so if you're working with these different pitchers who do have skills and do have, you know, things to offer, including Bowden Francis, who I think can still be a useful major league pitcher for the Blue Jays this year, you have to mix and match a little bit more. You don't just hand him a game and say, it's yours from start to finish. You might do that with Bassett, Berríos, and Gausman to a degree. But I think with the other two spots, it makes sense to be a little craftier, even if, you know, it's not fun for anyone and no one would draw it up this way.
You know, Ben, we kind of knew that the depth was a problem, but I keep going back to the bold predictions segment that we did with Sho Ali even before the season started. And I don't even know if you remembered this, but one of yours was that the hitters would be fine and the pitching would be the disappointing element of this team. Now, do you feel smart a few months removed?
thank you, Julia. I'm glad you remembered that. And I was listening last week when you were on the show, I think, and you mentioned, I was driving and you mentioned that. And I was like, yes, that's a great, so thank you. But no, I don't feel especially smart on that because I am humbled by so many of the other predictions I have made and the listeners and readers who remind me of the ways that I went wrong. So no, not going to get too high off my own supply there. But I will say that I continue to believe that. I continue to believe that the Blue Jays have a good core of bats that can help them a lot this year. And Santander and Varsho aren't even on the major league roster right now. So I think they're in a good spot from that standpoint. And I think the pitching, clearly, as we're talking about it, and as, you know, we all talk about it every week, the pitching is a really big question for this team.
They are 26th in starter ERA. Now, that includes, like I said, 9 bullpen games, a short stint from Scherzer, the 4 or 5 Easton Lucas starts, 4 Easton Lucas starts. So it's not a perfect measure. Like, Berríos, Bassett, and Gausman all have sub-4 ERAs, but not good when you're 26th in starter ERA overall. And Ben, to the feeling smart about it, this is, I joked with you the other day, it's like, the best thing you could be is positive and correct, but the second best thing you could be is not positive and incorrect, it's negative and correct. It's better to be negative and right than be, like, overly optimistic and end up wrong, unfortunately.
Yes. No, I heard that segment and I agree. Yeah, it's tough. I mean, predicting baseball in so many ways is a fool's errand. Once in a while you get something right and you're just like, oh my goodness, this is so fun. Because it is really fun when you get something right. But I think if we're realistic about this, yeah, it's a tough sport to predict. And look, I talk to people in the game and I hear their predictions and they're not always right either. Yeah. I mean, look at some of the contracts and how they go. So it's just a tough sport. I think we all have to embrace it. And it's a lot more fun when you can just let yourself be wrong once in a while, because it is inevitable.
Yeah, I think last year when Show did the bold predictions things, I had two, and one was Bowden Francis like being an everyday star. I think he just missed the innings total that I had given it, but the other one was like Connor Cook being a relevant piece of the Blue Jays major league bullpen, and then his elbow flew off.
Yeah.
So that's a tough one.
It happens
there too. Ben, on the offensive side, so a lot of stuff has been clicking. A question that came up in the text line a couple times this week, though, is, we're in another one of these kind of valleys with Vladimir Guerrero Jr.'s power production. He's fourth on the team in OPS. That's an OPS north of 800, so still very solid, very contact-oriented. I guess the two-part here is, are you seeing anything under the hood that tells you this is anything other than the usual Vlad ebbs and flows? And B, is this mostly just because he wants to slide more? He's your second favorite slider in baseball, and you can't slide on a home run.
Exactly. Yeah, I will say I do think Vladdy's an elite slider. Trey Turner versus Vladdy this weekend. That's it. That's the one versus two right there. Trey Turner, so graceful. You have to put him number one. But as far as the main question there, Blake, I think that we all see the numbers on FanGraphs and Baseball Savant. You can look at the projections, as I'm sure you guys have. You can look at the Baseball Savant page. You can see it's all red. So Vladdy, when it comes to bat speed, barreling baseballs, hitting the ball hard, we all know how good he is at that. And to me, when you look at his history in the course of his career, when he's healthy, he's an amazing hitter. And it includes more power than what we've seen recently. So I expect Vladdy to be an amazing hitter. And I expect more power than what we've seen recently.
And as long as, the Blue Jays are getting those contributions from elsewhere, I think Vladdy has time to figure some things out here. And one of the biggest, I think, even surprises, Ben, to that point, has been Alejandro Kirk, right? We all know about the contact skills, but he's hitting the ball extremely hard. And when you look at the season as a whole, we're wondering where you would rank Alejandro Kirk as an offensive player for this team.
Wow. Yeah. Probably definitely behind Vladdy and Bichette. Who else? Barger, I think, at least against right-handed pitching, is ahead of Kirk for me, just the way he's going. Springer's been amazing. He has to be in that discussion too. And Santander, I would put ahead of Kirk when you look at him as an offensive player when he's healthy. But we've seen Kirk hitting third, hitting fourth, hitting fifth for this team. And I think that's clearly deserved. There's no problem at all with him hitting in those spots. So you want him up there. You want him getting a lot of at-bats. The late clutch performance has been incredible. Certainly you trust him in those situations. I actually think that as a pinch hitter on days that Heinemann's catching, you love having Kirk off the bench, because if you need a single, he's your guy. If you need a ball in the gap, he can do that for you. So, him and Clement actually both, I think, are elite pinch hit type options because of their contact skills. So yeah, I think that you're really happy to have Kirk up there. 120 games. I mean, his workload's pretty heavy. He might end up catching a ton this year.
Yeah, which is, we had Benji Molina on the show the other day, and I went looking through his like baseball card. I'm like, holy cow, how do you start 120 games behind the plate this often? It's crazy. I think he had 10 95 plus game seasons, and like five or six of those were like 120 plus. Nobody does that anymore. And then so that was a question, but the offensive side, and then we take into the defensive value, Kirk is lapping the rest of the team when it comes to something like wins above replacement that tries to take all of those things into consideration. Another name who could be pinch hit relevant this weekend, he probably isn't going to start the first two games because there are lefty starters on the mound in Ranger Suarez and Christopher Sanchez. Will Robertson got the call the other day. You were in St. Louis. What was the chatter around Robertson joining the team?
Really cool story for a guy who was drafted 6 years ago to finally make it to the major leagues. And he has great numbers, as you guys know, 12 homers, 991 OPS in AAA. Like, those are really good numbers. But it's kind of weird timing in a little bit of a way, because they're facing Liberatore and then Suarez and Sanchez. Like, it's not exactly clear what his role will be other than to provide some depth. So, especially given that he was off the 40 man, you could have taken Aroldis Martinez, who's a right-handed hitter and on the 40 man. I was a little surprised. I mean, it's a great, great story. And people in that clubhouse were really happy for Will Robertson when he got that call. So always cool to see. I hope he gets into a game to, you know, get that major league debut and kind of continue that story. But yeah, roster fit wise, it's kind of an interesting one, because if there's one thing this team has a lot of, it's left-handed hitting outfielders.
Yeah, and that was also the case like at the AAA level before all these guys got called up. So he's only faced 14 lefties the entire minor league season. So even in terms of like, would he get a start here and there? Last year, he actually had really good numbers against lefties last year. But again, we're talking fewer than 100 plate appearances. So he hasn't seen very much left-handed pitching the last couple of years either. And the 40-man thing's interesting. Like Aroldis Martinez is one thing. You probably could have just like added Michael Stefanik back, because you don't care if you have to DFA him when you 40-man it back. So I don't know. I'm all for a positive story. And we had talked about Will Robertson a few times on the show, but it is at least moderately interesting that was the choice over someone who fit the next couple games a little differently.
It would be surprising, though, if he didn't come into a game, right?
Yeah, I think as a pinch hitter, for sure. But I don't think, like, his first major league appearance, I don't know if you want him facing Ranger Suarez or Christopher Sanchez as, like, his first time up, right?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't, personally. But, I would also like to see some, you know, Will Robertson in some way, shape, or form here.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, too, because let's say he gets in, let's say he has a couple good weeks. Mm-hmm. It's not inconceivable to me, and this is total speculation, yep. So let's be very clear about that, but it's not inconceivable that someone like that could be traded. And if the Blue Jays are going to make trades, they are going to have to give up players that are doing well in the minor leagues. You don't trade the guys who have, you know, a 6 ERA in Vancouver. You have to give up something somewhat interesting. So I think that, you know, realistically, that's one possibility on the table among others.
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect, because like there is such a glut too of like most of them are in the majors right now. But you look at even before these call-ups, we were looking at Yohindrik Panongo and RJ Schreck and being like, there's not even space for them at AAA. And obviously, look, it's not the best system in baseball. These guys all aren't going to be Barry Bonds and Aaron Judge. But when you look ahead to the trade deadline, there is a pretty big glut of like major league fourth outfielder types. You do have one particular area of strength to deal from come deadline, and maybe you don't have, you know, we're gonna have Jeff Ponce on the show next week, and he's pretty optimistic about the system in general. You're maybe not gonna have the best A-plus chips. Like, you're not trading Arjun Amala or Treya Savage at the deadline, I don't think, unless it's like an unbelievable, like, that guy's not getting put, like, Ronald Acuna Jr. is not getting put on the trade table. So you don't need to worry about that kind of stuff. But it is helpful, especially when you look at some of the smaller market teams that value, like, either volume over one high-end guy. So we know the Athletics value that. For example, the White Sox have generally valued guys who are close to the majors, projectable guys who can be inexpensive major leaguers in the short time. Those are the kind of trade partners that the Jays should start to line up with well when we get talking about this stuff in July.
Yeah, get these guys in front of some pro scouts and see what happens. Maybe they have a great game. Maybe it helps their value. I think, too, like this series against the Phillies highlights a potential need for the Blue Jays, because as good as they have been offensively, and I believe, but think about the lineup tonight. I'm guessing that Davis Schneider probably starts in left field. Mm-hmm. And Davis Schneider's had some great stretches, but that's an area that you could look to upgrade potentially. If you could find a right-handed hitting bat who gives you just more offensively than what Davis Schneider gives you, is someone like Austin Hayes available? Is there, you know, Andrew McCutchen's getting up there in age, but he's performed. There are potential right-handed bats out there who might be an upgrade over that spot on the roster. And so I think that as these other outfielders in the minor leagues perform, maybe it's a little Perfido, maybe it's even a Class A, depending on the acquisition. I don't, you know, they're not giving up Class A for Andrew McCutchen, but I think that depending on the acquisition, some of these outfielders, like a Benango, for example, could be used to try to tempt a team into giving up one of their major league outfielders and filling a need on the Blue Jays roster.
Yeah, and it's amusing because like a lot of these names we're kicking around are guys they picked up at last year's deadline. But this is why it's important to restock the cupboards, because now you got more arrows in the quiver to take your shot now in a competitive year versus if you hadn't sold off last year, you don't have the 13 extra prospects, you know, and some of them you hope long term are contributors at the major league level and things like that. But sometimes it's just, yeah, you gotta have depth to deal from. Ben, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Blake. Thanks, Julia.
Ben Nicholson-Smith of Sportsnet. New episode of At the Letters came out yesterday, I believe, as well. Was listening to a little of that this morning, two. It's a busy morning.
Busy morning for you. Yeah. You watched two baseball games and listened to
a
podcast?
I watched 4 innings of one team pitching. I didn't watch two full baseball games. I just clicked through the Stanifer and Yesavage parts. It was like an hour total. It's not a...
Well, here's my morning. I woke up and I came in to do the show. That's it.
Boom. Well, didn't even bring me a coffee.
Unbelievable. Didn't even bring you a coffee.
Unbelievable.
Right.
After that story about Matt Bonner getting me an Orlando Robinson card, you didn't even come correct with a coffee.
That's why I was excited to win bingo. I was like, I'm just going to win something for Blake, and then I'm going to present it during the show, and I'm going to one-up his other co-host.
Yeah.
Couldn't even do that.
Yeah.
So,
couldn't win.
Whatever.
Unbelievable. Don't care about me whatsoever. All right. Let's take a break. Let's get the Philly side of this series. We'll go down to Philly. We'll talk to Adam Aronson of the Philly Voice, get the skinny on Ranger Suarez, Christopher Sanchez. We're going to see Zach Wheeler on Sunday, which is really, really fun as a baseball fan and really not fun as someone who would like the Blue Jays bats to stay hot. Zach Wheeler rocks. I will see him. That's next as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. Jays back in action tonight. I do not like an off day. I do not like two off days over a five-day stretch. I'm sorry, Julia. I know you would probably like to do things like drag brunch and enjoy your Monday next week. I don't want any off days. No days off. No momentum killing when you've won 12 or 14.
And it does take us out of our rhythm, too. We were just talking about it at the break a little bit. We'll definitely get over it, and we'll do better, but it's kind of weird.
Yeah, and we'll see if it has an effect on the Jays. They are back in action tonight. It's Kevin Gausman against Ranger Suarez at 6:45 tonight. 4:05 game tomorrow, 1:35 game on Sunday, and fun pitching matchups abound with Christopher Sanchez and Zach Wheeler the rest of the series. Let's go to Philly, and let's hear about it. We'll talk to Adam Aronson of the Philly Voice. Adam, what's up, man? How you doing?
Doing great. Good to be with you guys.
I'm going to open with this because you are also a Philadelphia 76ers guy. I know you're covering the Phillies and covering the NBA draft stuff right now. The Toronto Raptors number 9 pick and Jeff Hoffman for the Philadelphia 76ers number 3 pick and Jordan Romano. Are you doing it?
I think most people in Philly would volunteer an extra first round pick if they needed to get that deal done. A lot of folks miss Jeff Hoffman. A lot of people not pleased with Jordan Romano so far, and a lot of Sixers fans that want to trade down. So we're checking off a lot of boxes here.
There we go. On the Romano front, so he was just here. We got to catch up with him a little bit in Toronto, and I know his performance has turned a corner a little bit. I don't know how much you've seen of the Blue Jays, but Jeff Hoffman, the save number looks really good. I think he's 17 for 20 on saves, but he's had some blips, some homers and things like that. I get that like 25 or 26 teams around baseball probably aren't like super comfortable with their closer situation, but it does seem like this has been, at least so far this season, like kind of a neutral swap, even if Phillies fans do miss Jeff Hoffman.
Yeah. Ironically, they've had similar seasons in certain respects. Both guys have inflated ERAs because of a few just really bad blowups that probably make their season look worse than they've actually been. But certainly neither guy has been, I think, exactly what their teams and fan bases hoped for. And the Phillies do miss Hoffman a lot because the role he had in Philly was a bit different. He was often just sort of the first high leverage spot of the game, you know, like the fireman sort of guy. When there were runners on base, he was far and away their most trusted arm in terms of getting out of those jams. And he was terrific with that for 2 years. And unfortunately for him and the Phillies, it sort of blew up in their face in the NLDS last year. But with Romano, it's been a challenge because he had struggles early on. And in a market like this, new guy struggles out the gate. And it's like, oh, man, they blew this signing. You know, at the time, Hoffman was pitching well to start his time in Toronto. And it was, you know, oh, my God, the Phillies blew it. This bullpen isn't good enough. And now it's even more important that Romano continues to figure it out the way that he largely has for the last, you know, 4 to 6 weeks. He started to find his footing because Jose Alvarado has another 2 months or so on the suspended list, and he won't be eligible for the postseason if the Phillies make it there. So the Phillies, I think everyone knows, they're going to have to reinforce their bullpen at some point. But they do hope that, you know, whether it's in the closer role that he's in now or some other featured high leverage spot, that Romano can be someone that they trust giving the ball to in October.
Yeah, this is, or it is, a tough market in Philly, right? And obviously the fan base is going to have very high expectations. That's not exclusive to this year. It's been historically that way, which makes me wonder, how are the vibes, sort of thing? You know, they come to Toronto, they lose 2 of 3, and then they're swept by the Pirates, take 2 of 3 against the Cubs. So it seems like things are getting a little bit back on track. Where is the sentiment at towards this team right now?
It's a great question. The vibes are suboptimal, I would say. There's a lot of skepticism. By the end of last season, the Phillies had, you know, their most successful regular season of this era of the team. They won 95 games. They won their first division since 2011. But the last 3 months of the season, they were about a 500 team, and they got embarrassed in the NLDS by their biggest rivals, arguably. And there was a lot of frustration now with, you know, in 2022, they lose in the World Series. 2023, they lose in the NLCS. 2024, they lose in the divisional round. And it, you know, everyone has looked at it as this linear progression of the Phillies getting worse and worse and worse. And they've largely run back the same team. And to be fair, it's a team that's been very good for a very long time, but it's a group of players that people have been frustrated with for a while, particularly offensively, the sort of free swinging, chase happy, boom or bust sort of players that they have. And they didn't really change their offense. They added Max Kepler on a 1-year deal, who's just been a platoon bat in left field. And other than that, the offense is basically the same as it always has been. And the offense has really underperformed because a lot of players who at the start of this sort of era of Phillies baseball were young players that, you know, were helpful with a lot of room to grow have either stayed the same or regressed. Talking about guys like Bryson Stott, Alec Bohm, Brandon Marsh. And they were relying on those guys to eventually pick up more of the slack as the Bryce Harpers and Kyle Schwarbers and Nick Castellanoses of the world get older. But it just hasn't quite clicked. They don't have enough quality production in their lineup. And there's a lot of frustration with it.
With Bryson Stott specifically, so he's 27 years old. He's hitting .237. OBP's under 300. Second season in a row where the OPS is sub 700. And finally, they moved him down in the order, even against righties. He's always hit down in the order against lefties, but that has now started happening against righties. And at a time when Bryce Harper hit the aisle, so you really couldn't afford to do that. What have you made, Adam, of the decision to finally do that? And is it a signpost that they're kind of out of patience with him figuring it out at the plate?
I wouldn't say out of patience with him figuring it out at the plate, but I think at least in the short term, they don't view him as a viable leadoff hitter anymore. And whether it's people with the team or just people who are around the Phillies, like to talk about how he has the sort of makeup of a leadoff hitter, the guy who sees a lot of pitches, has a patient approach, has a good sort of understanding of the strike zone, a great base runner. If he gets on, he can steal second, but he just doesn't hit enough. It really is as simple as that. The quality of contact has really never been strong with him. 2023, he had a strong offensive season, was an above league average hitter. Really, the other 3 years of his career, including this one, he's been a noticeably below average hitter. And that's just who he is. And that doesn't mean he's not a useful player. He's excellent at second base. He has those qualities that I mentioned earlier. It's a perfectly fine 8 or 9 hole hitter. But they were trying to justify leading him off because, frankly, they have 3 hitters that they can justify hitting in the top 4 of an order. And they had to find someone, whether that's keeping Kyle Schwarber behind Bryce Harper and finding a new leadoff hitter, because Schwarber had been a wildly successful leadoff hitter his first 3 years here, whether it was that or putting Schwarber back in the leadoff spot and finding someone to hit cleanup. And ultimately what they're doing now is they're leading off Trey Turner and they're hitting Nick Castellanos cleanup. And that will work for the time being because Castellanos is in the middle of one of his stretches where he's great. But that usually means you're a few weeks away from a stretch where it's a little less successful. And then they're going to have the same issue again. It's impossible to be a bad team with the quality of starting pitching that the Phillies have. But I would argue that it largely sort of caps your ceiling when you have so many underwhelming bats in your lineup on a day-to-day basis. And Harper being out with this wrist injury, and it's very unclear when he's going to be back. There's no sort of timeline yet. They said they don't think it's a major long-term injury, but we also have no idea if there's even an internal idea of a timeline yet. That just heightens the importance of guys like Stott and Marsh and Bohm to, you know, pick up the slack. And then someone like Schwarber, who had an unbelievable start to the year and started to stump a little bit. He did homer the other day. It puts more pressure on him that, you know, he can't have a week-long slump because they're going to be rudderless offensively. So it just, you know, it's a compounding effect sort of thing where up and down the lineup, Harper being out and certain guys not, you know, making the strides that the Phillies expected offensively just sort of hurts the whole operation.
The answer to this is probably going to be largely about managing the 40 man and not starting the service time clock early and things like that. But given how badly they could use an offensive spark, were you surprised at all that when Harper hit the IL, it wasn't Justin Crawford who got the call given the speed and on-base profile that he's been able to show? I know he's just 21, so maybe it's just a little too soon, but I kind of had my eyes on that when Harper hit the IL just because it seems like they could use, even if it's in the bottom third of the lineup, you know, someone who can get something going to give the team a little bit of juice in the back third.
Yeah, there are a lot of people here asking the same question, why Crawford's not up. He's hitting almost 350 as a 21-year-old at AAA, and has it's reflective of the success he's had at every level, basically, of his baseball life. I had a hard time imagining it just because I think they would want to bring him up when there's a clear runway for him to play every day. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that exists now unless they were optioning Brandon Marsh, who actually has started to figure things out of late. The Crawford thing is really fascinating to me. He's one of the more interesting Phillies prospects I can remember because what a lot of people believe around here is that they sort of sent him to AAA aggressively, almost prematurely, because they wanted him to face adversity. He's got an interesting swing where he hits the ball really hard, but it's always into the ground. If you look at his ground ball rates, I don't know, have the exact numbers in front of me, but it's almost comical how many ground balls he hits. But he has the sort of power, like raw power, that if he, you know, adjusted his swing, he could be a 20 home run player, which is, you know, of course, that would be the optimal version of anyone, is if they're hitting 20 home runs instead of right now he has one in AAA Lehigh Valley. But it hasn't really happened because his bat to ball skills are just so good that he's still, again, as a young 21-year-old at AAA, he's hitting almost 350 as the leadoff hitter for, I believe, the best offense in the International League. It is really almost perplexing to some degree that with these sort of glaring flaws in his approach, he's still so productive. But to answer your initial question, I was not totally surprised just because I think they want to, when they bring him up, be ready to just, you know, whether it's center field or left field, whatever it is, just give him that spot every day and not have him worrying that, you know, if in 10 days from now, you know, I'm batting 150 in a, you know, 30 plate appearance sample, I'm going to get sent back down and it's going to feel like a setback.
Yeah, that's a good point. His ground ball rate is 64%, which makes Christopher Sanchez look like a fly ball pitcher, which is not the case. Right. That's a great point there. Even with the line drive rate up, like, yeah, 64% is crazy.
We will get to see Christopher Sanchez. Yeah, I think it's the final game of that.
Saturday.
Yeah. Okay. And Zach Wheeler. The Blue Jays are not going to be lucky enough to miss Zach Wheeler twice this season. I know that they've been unlucky enough to see them twice a bunch of times in seasons prior, Adam. But it seems very clear that he's the anchor. He's the captain of this rotation. And I'm just wondering how valuable it is to have a guy like that at the realm and at the helm, rather, and, you know, delivering as consistently as Zach Wheeler does.
Yeah, and consistently, that's the key word there. The consistency that Wheeler has from start to start is, I think, unparalleled in baseball. I think you could say there are better pitchers. I think, like, Skubal and Skeens are probably more productive pitchers at this point. But the level of consistency that Wheeler has is almost hard to fathom. He had a start a couple weeks ago against the Braves where he gave up four runs in five innings, and it felt like legitimately stunning that he could have a start like that. I forget where the streak ended. He had a quality start streak that I think went into the 20s that started last summer and ended early on this year. It just almost feels unfathomable when he's pitching that he's going to have a bad outing. And it usually he has one or two blowups a year. He had one in 21 and one in 24 that probably both cost him the Cy Young, actually both were against the AL East, though not against the Blue Jays. But he just is the ultimate symbol of like consistent excellence. It is like there in a city where all people want to do is be nervous and people want to come up with reasons why their team is going to lose. When Zach Wheeler is on the mound, there is just an overwhelming confidence here that like to achieve that sort of like to establish that dynamic in Philadelphia is like more of a testament than anything else of how consistently dominant he's been since he got here in 2020. It's really, I mean, and every statistical benchmark you could look for, he's just brilliant. His last start was the first time he gave up a run in the first inning all year, which is, you know, generally the unless you were playing against the Phillies for the last 3 weeks, you know, you're facing the best hitters when you're in the first inning.
Yeah.
It's just, I mean, I could, you know, I think anyone who's been around the Phillies and has watched the Phillies since Wheeler got here in 2020 could talk for hours uninterrupted about how special his time here has been and how dominant he's been on such a consistent basis.
He has been in the league for 11 years, and the only time he had an ERA above four was an injury-shortened 2017. Five of the last 6 years, he actually has a sub-3 ERA. It's ludicrous. I don't want to see it on Sunday. I do want to see it on Sunday, obviously. Adam, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Good luck with all the draft prep. I'm sure we'll be kicking around in the DMs about that next week as well.
Yes, we will. Thank you so much. Good to be with you both.
Adam Aronson of the Philly Voice. Great 76ers stuff, great Philly stuff. And yeah, we won't see Jesus Luzardo in this one, but he had a good piece coming out of Jesus Luzardo's last start, because Luzardo, after giving up, becoming one of the first players in Major League history to give up 20 earned runs over a two-start stretch, then bounced back a little bit, mercifully, as someone who has a few Jesus Luzardo fantasy shares. That was a big relief. So we won't see Luzardo, but we will see lefties today and tomorrow in Ranger Suarez and Christopher Sanchez. So Ranger Suarez, he has been very, very good. So he got a late start to the season due to injury, got rocked in his first game back, but has a 1.36 ERA over the six starts then. Very much a true 5-6 pitch pitcher. Chris Bassitt throws 8 pitches, but you know, it's I'll throw this to righties, I'll throw this to lefties, I'll ditch this, I'll bring it back when I need it, that kind of thing. Ranger Suarez, 5 different pitches that he throws at least 14% of the time, and none of them does he throw more than 30% of the time. So this is a go up there and just guess, I guess.
Super even, yeah.
The Jays have done a good job against lefties. They've won 5 of their last 6 against lefties. They're not hitting the cover off the ball the way they are against righties, but very good swing decisions, very good you know, plate discipline metrics and things like that. You're going to have to do that because Ranger Suarez has the lowest hard hit rate among all qualified pitchers. On the other side, it'll be Kevin Gausman. Unreal 4-game stretch for Kevin Gausman, especially with the splitter. He's got that nice fastball and splitter velocity gap. The splitter's getting more depth and horizontal break to it, or vertical break to it, rather. So the stuff that we've kind of been tracking with Kevin Gausman's splitter has very much been there of late. What are you looking forward to this weekend?
It's pretty funny that we spoke about Kevin Gausman so much and about the splitter, and then now it's like you don't have to worry about it anymore. Like, that is just, he's back to normal, and that chatter kind of just died, which is a good thing. It's definitely a good thing because the Blue Jays have enough concerns.
He started last Saturday, and then he's starting Friday night tonight. So it'll be back-to-back starts where we don't get to talk about it the next day. That might also be why it feels we haven't talked about it as much, because he hasn't started on a show night in a little while.
That's
here.
That's a good point.
Yeah, it's the last two starts, he gave up 3 runs in each of them. The Athletics start, he didn't get out of the fifth, but the splitter has looked really good. He's looked really good on the mound. The strikeout numbers are there. So no real concern level for me with Kevin Gausman whatsoever. The other matchups, like I mentioned, Bowden Francis against Christopher Sanchez, Saturday at 4:05. Sunday at 1:35, it's Jose Berrios against Zach Wheeler. Little programming note, we got Ben Schulman with Caleb Joseph and Hazel May on the television broadcast this weekend. We've got Brad Fay with Madison Shipman on Blue Jay Central. I'll join them tomorrow on Blue Jay Central.
Nice.
And then we have Eric Smith with Chris LaRue and Sho Ali on the radio side. So we're mixing it up. We'll see if the winning streaks can keep rolling. Thanks so much to Adam Aronson, Arjun Amala, Pat Malacaro, and Ben Nicholson-Smith. Thanks to Ahmed Austin, Brandon and Jennifer behind the glass. Thanks to all of you. Hope you have a wonderful weekend. We'll talk to you Monday.